Alan Crane Productions, in association with the Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2024. Today, stock valuation. Now, you'll have a quiz after a little while. I also wanted to make sure that you know, Canvas somehow got another one of my classes confused with yours, so you might have seen a notification for an assignment that has nothing to do with your class. And I'm still trying to fix some of that mess, but if you saw a notification for some weird assignment, that's not yours at all. And I don't know why Canvas did that, but I'll try to find out so I can make sure it doesn't happen again. Before we get to the meat of the lecture, of course, we'll have our look at the numbers. And the numbers are unusual. And this is the second time this week that I've seen this. We have a bull market today, greens everywhere, green charts, but the Dow is up the most. It should be up. Oh no, you're not allowed to. You're not allowed to see it. There you go. You can see the green, but the Dow is up the most at over 0.75%, and the S&P 500, which should be above the Dow on a bull day, is up just a little more than 0.33%. And then you've got the NASDAQ, which should be up the most in a bull day. It's barely eking out a positive number at 0.04 or 0.05%. So this is one of those days when there's bullish information is favoring the bulls, but it appears that this information is much more beneficial to, at least to as far as investors are concerned, to the bigger stocks. The bigger the stock, the better the information seems to be. Not something you usually see, but there you are. We got an odd day today. Now, moving over, crude is working to, it's down at the near the bottom of that new trading range from 81 to 87 or 88. It actually went below, back into the below the trading range for a while, and then it finally got back up above it. But still, we have oil prices that just can't seem to find a good reason to be going up right now. Now, is that going to affect the price of gasoline? Probably not. We might see a little bit of a drop in the price of gasoline, but it's still up there in the 80s, so we'd like to see it go back down in the 70s before we get too excited. Gold, it broke that $2,200 per ounce neckline, and it's gotten up there to the point where it seems to want to stay on the top side of it now. Today was an up day, but silver was up too, but boy, silver was volatile today. But it looks like metals in general are having a price rise, at least for the past few days. Now, the 10-year bond, the yield is down 3.8 basis points. So yield is down. Yay, interest rates are slipping a little bit. But that also means prices are up. If the yield is down, the price is up. That means that there's buying of bonds. There's buying of capital is being put into bonds, being put into stocks. That's a sign that the economy is in decent shape. There's generally a bullish market, both in equities and in debt. So that's good news for all of us, as far as the economy is concerned. Nikkei had a good day, until about the last hour or so, and there was some profit taking there at the very end of the day. And when the sun set in Tokyo and finally got over to rising in London, London just was having another one of its grouchy days. Although there, just after the noon hour in London, you did see a bull run and got it back up just barely into positive territory by the end. So, you know, bullish around the world. What does that mean? Well, for the time being, the investment community, on average, is in a happy mood. And let's hope they stay that way because of a happy economy. But there you are. Now, let me switch gears here. It's time to talk about stocks. Now, the way I will arrange this, I put up a spreadsheet for what I did on Monday and for what I'm doing today, but one of a student said it's a mess, and so I went in and it was just numbers, a mess of numbers. So I've deleted it and I'll re-upload it this weekend for you. But it has the math of this. Now, like I said, today will not be math, or just a little stupid arithmetic, maybe. But the math is on Monday, and you will be really grateful for that, to be able to do this in Excel. Not because it's particularly a tough math, it's just a lot of steps sometimes, and Excel is great at doing stepwise problems. So stay tuned for that. That'll be on Monday. But for now, we have stock. A stock represents ownership. We sometimes call it equity. That's a fancy term. So if you wanted to sound fancy, you wouldn't say, well, I own a share of stock. You would say, well, I'm long equity. It's just a more sophisticated term. So that's equity, represents ownership. What has the residual claim to the cash flows after the debt holders have been paid what they're owed by the for the period of time? And so we have two kinds of stock, common stock and preferred stock. They are both equity, but they're a little bit different. And I will talk about preferred stock on Monday, because I'll talk about that in the context of the math of preferred stock. But as far as common stock goes, it represents the owner's interest. So if you own one share of Microsoft, which has maybe, 10 billion shares outstanding, you own 1/10 billionth of Microsoft. It's ownership. Now the company, and so when there is profit, you are allowed to have that profit. You can have it by dividend, or the company can put it back into the company, which is your company, on your behalf. So that's what we call plowback. But either way, that's your money. And common stock represents your claim to that residual, what's left after the debt holders are paid. So it's nothing terribly complicated about that, but common stock isn't as common as you might think. There are different animals that are common stock, and it doesn't hurt to know those different kinds of common stock, especially if you are an investor in stocks. Sometimes people don't know that what they're owning is what they've bought is common stock, but it might not be exactly what you think it is. First things first, common stock, the owners of the common stock elect the board of directors every year at the annual shareholders meeting. And then those board of directors are charged with representing only the interests of the shareholders. It's called fiduciary duty, and I'll get to that at the end of the course. But so, for example, say you own one share of common stock. You, madam, you own one share of common stock. Now, the board of directors comprises, let's say, by the charter of this company, four specific positions: president, vice president, treasurer, and secretary. Now, that one share of common stock allows you one vote for each of those positions at the annual shareholders meeting. You get to vote, one vote for who's going to be the president, one vote for who's going to be the vice president, one vote for who's going to be the treasurer, and one vote for who's going to be the secretary. Now, in some companies, and it would depend upon how the charter is set up, you could actually concentrate all of your votes on only one position. So we have these four board members, they're vying against competitors for the position. And I have a share of stock. Now I could vote 1-1-1-1. But in some companies, I could say, I need to get rid of that scoundrel right there. So I'm going to say 0-0-0-4 for your opponent. Okay? That's in some companies, you can do that. You can concentrate your vote on one individual. That's not in all companies, though. Matter of fact, I think I had stock at one time in a company, and I got the vote thing. I didn't quite understand how this one shareholder, one board member, had so many votes against him. And it was because sometimes a group will get together, a group of shareholders, and they will have an agreement. We all hate the president, so we're going to all concentrate our votes for someone besides this president. That's been done on occasions. You also have voting blocks that will agree to vote for specific people to be on a board. And that has, sometimes it has no effect, but sometimes it's influential. And it can signal the company, reform your ways. This is something that happens, for example, if a company, enough shareholders have a feeling that the company is not pursuing green policies, and it's all because of this one vote, one board member, they can get together and they might be able to send a message, we can kick someone out if we want to. Same is true, it was a long time ago, well before your time. There was a country called South Africa, which is still around, but at that time it was run as an apartheid. In other words, the white minority from Europe, from the Netherlands, controlled the country, and these vast millions of black people were given no voice, basically. They were treated like crap. And enough companies said, we're going to not be here because of your system. Why did they say that? Not out of the goodness of their heart, but because some pretty heavy stockholders said, we're going to start voting against your some board members who are the problem. The same has happened with other social issues. One that's big on the table right now is DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there are some voting blocs that are saying we need to get board members that are a little more enlightened. Another one that has just come up very recently is efforts through the voting on the board of directors to get divestiture from a new target, Israel. And whether they're going to succeed or not is speculative, but it is a recurring thing, concentrating voter blocks of voters for the shareholders toward altering policies of the company. It works sometimes. It doesn't work ever in other times. And when it does work, it's usually a long-term process that is in play. However, now taking that as just an aside, I'm going to take you through the legal side of what we call stock here for a few minutes. Make sure you write this down. I've said most of this earlier in the course. This is where I put the teeth in it. This is where you have to remember for quizzes and final exam. Here's the thing about what does stock mean? It means ownership. But there's a whole lot behind it. I used to do this. This was what I did as a consultant. One of the things I did. First things first is that you, as a company, you've got a nice little company you started, and you decide, I'm going to sell some stock. Wow. Get some new owners in. Well, if you do that, you will probably end up being fined, and you'll be may even be thrown in prison, which happened to a client of mine long ago. Sold stock without doing what you have to do. In order to know about what you have to do, I go back to a time in history, the 1920s, and before that. The most countries of the world that were of any strength whatsoever had their economics of policy was what we call neoclassical. You may have heard about it in your economics class. Free market. The best government is no government. Government should be small enough that you can drown it in a bathtub. Laissez-faire, which is the French word for leave it alone. Let businesses do what businesses do. It's all fun. Let them, they'll work it out, they'll sort it out. Well, in fact, that leads to catastrophes sometimes. And even the father of modern neoclassical economics, Adam Smith, he even said, you shouldn't do it that way when capitalism gets to the point of market concentration. Competition is what it should be about. Okay, 1920s, roaring 20s, craziness, scams, cons, and all kinds of things in banking and in securities. A fly-by-night selling stock, companies taking money and then disappearing into the night, the founders. It was just craziness. Big, powerful, wealthy families and corporations running the markets and manipulating stock prices. And it all came to an end on a Black Friday in 1920. Black Monday in 1929. The stock market crashed, and it didn't just crash. It hit the ground and cratered. It was a very black day. And that was just the beginning of it. The economy of the wealthy had been doing great, but for the vast majority of people, the middle class, the working poor, the very poor, it was getting worse and worse, and then everything fell into the toilet in the Great Depression. 1932 election, the voters of the country had enough of this free market crap, and they kicked out every scoundrel in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, and in the White House. And they put in hardcore reformers who had no problem with getting the fist of government to come down on all of these nonsense games in different industries. Banking, labor, and insecurities, they went to work. First, in 1933, the Securities Act of 1933. This set up the regulation of the primary market. You remember the primary market. It also established an agency to oversee enforcement. That agency was called the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. And that's, in other words, the SEC would review the laws, and then it would enforce those laws through the agency. And it would enforce and punish with civil actions, fines against bad guys. And if it was bad enough, they would refer cases to the DOJ, the Department of Justice, for criminal prosecution. And they had the full power to step up to the DOJ and say, here's what we've gathered. We're taking them civilly. You take the criminal side of this and double whammy them. So that began to send the messages to the to the securities industry that a very big 800-pound gorilla was coming online to take care of it. Paralleling the Securities Act of 1933 was the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And this one took on the secondary markets and cracked down on them and gave the SEC the power to deal with, you know, buying stocks and bonds in open markets. And the two of them together, those two laws and the SEC's power to enforce and to refer, brought the securities industry under control. Now, over the decades, the enforcement has, in some eras and under some presidents, been very weak, and under other presidents, it was very strong. And I, in my time as a consultant, maybe 15, 20 years, I saw both sides of it. When I was at the heaviest of my work, it was like in the middle of the road, a little more toward the lax side. I was working, most of my work was during the Clinton administration, a neoliberal administration that was very much favored by businesses because they were business friendly. And I probably got by with more than I should have, quite honestly, in that time. But anyway, and so did some real rather bad players who are now famous companies because they were ignored when they were doing bad things during that time. But, okay, so there's the setup. Now, the next part of this is that you can't just go out there and sell ownership stock in a corporation or in any business entity, because you are playing a game that you're not allowed to play. By the securities laws, you must register with the federal government any offering of certain types of securities. Now, that registration, now there are a few exemptions. These rules about registration are to protect your typical investor. But if I say I'm going to start a company and I'm going to sell stock ownership, I've got a company myself. I've got 501 shares of 1,000 that are authorized. So I could sell 10 shares to someone. I could. But if I do it, I have to invoke one of these exemptions from registration. The classic one is sophisticated investors. You are a sophisticated investor. You've got a lot of money, you're well educated, and you have good counsel from an accountant or lawyer. So I could probably sell you ownership in my company, 10 shares or 100 shares. And if the SEC came sniffing around, I'd say, sophisticated investor, and I'd invoke something like Reg D 506, something like that. Regulation D is one of the, it lists some exemptions from registration. But if I don't have that, I have to go through a hell of a process. And I don't do it just with the SEC. Any state where I would offer and sell some stock, I have to register with that state too. Now, some states, if the SEC says okay, then the state will do it. Other states are just an absolute bitch. And I'll give you an example. It's not a real example, but suppose that I've got a registration that was qualified by the SEC, and I'm sitting in a cafe in Chicago, and I start trying to talk someone into buying my stock. It's registered, but what happens if I registered it in Illinois, but But it turns out this person is from Wisconsin. I have violated Wisconsin securities laws. They have them too. So I would have to register in any state where there could be an offer, a sale, or a solicitation for an offer to buy the stock. It's just the way it is. So, and that gets expensive. Now, in my time, I did a bunch of small offerings, but the big 800-pound gorilla of offering, of registration statements, is the Form S-1. Now, there are some littler registrations, SB-1 and SB-2 under it. And I did an SB-1, but I once actually took on a full S-1 on my own. It's illegal now for me to even talk about it outside of a classroom. They would very quickly put me in prison and fine me ungodly amounts of money. But Form S-1 is the giant. And I did one in my life. You fill out all of this, all of these required documents. This is the Form S-1. Let's say this big long paper. Now there, at the back in that time, there were three pieces to it. The first was like a preliminary. Who, what, when, where. It's a boilerplate. Goes on for more than a few pages. And at the end, the last set of documents is your audited financial statements. The middle part is actually a selling document. It's called the prospectus. That's the selling document you give to potential investors. You cannot give this to investors until the SEC says go. There's a version of it called a red herring. It's called a red herring because you have to have all of these headers and titles and things like that in red ink. And that you can kind of let people have a peek at. You can show that to them, but you make it clear, it got right at the top. This is not the selling document. It's just showing you what's about to happen, kind of thing. The prospectus, the real prospectus, can't be used until it goes live. Now, about going live. It was 1995, I think, or four. A company wanted to do a really serious IPO. And they heard that I'll do them, and I was a lot cheaper than having a law firm do it. And I had done some little baby versions of registrations, Reg D 504s and stuff like that. But this was a monster, and I put it all together, which looked like magic back then because hardly anyone had a computer, and I did, and I had software called WordPerfect and Lotus 123, so it looked like I was doing heroic things, and I wasn't. But anyway, fill out all that monster stuff there, and then you send it to the SEC in triplicate on paper. Yes, this was in the Stone Age. And just wait. Well, one day, some weeks later, my fax machine turned on. And I swear to God, it did not turn off for well over an hour. These were the deficiencies that the SEC had found in my filing, my S-1. 437 deficiencies. And of course, I just decided I was going to quit and go join a hippie commune and stuff like that. Called a consultant friend of mine, and I just started blubbering about it. He said, how many? 437. Well, that's not bad. And it turned out that most of them were just formatting errors. Just formatting. Well, you should have had this in this size font. You should have had these margins. So it got down. I fixed everything. Fortunately, on WordPerfect, you saved the file back then on a floppy disk drive. And I submitted again. Couple of weeks later, fax machine turns back on. I thought, here we go. Only 6 deficiencies. And they were all just technical things that I hadn't caught the first time. Submitted again, and this is when the magic happened. The government at any level does not approve a filing. That's not a term in government. The wording is they qualify. The SEC qualified the offering. In other words, they said you've met all of the requirements of the Securities Act of 1933 as amended, as per our regulations thereupon. But that begins the quiet period where you shut up about it. You produce a red herring, yeah, because the SEC has qualified the whole document, so the prospectus is good, and you have a printer print out the prospectus with the red lettering and the disclosures and disclaimers and all that kind of stuff, and just stay quiet. Now, one thing that can happen during the quiet period is that the pricing may change. You may change the price per share. Now, you'll file it with a specific price. Back then, you did anyway. Like $23 a share. But say the market had a really nice surge during the quiet period, you might open and say, change at the last minute to $25 a share. You can do little things like that. But anyway, then the quiet period ended and the offering went live. We could sell in the states where we had done parallel registrations. But here's a problem with that. You can sell stock, but if the company doesn't have a trading symbol, you got nothing. That's a completely different process. That one's the one that goes through a stock exchange. Now, in my case, it was the NASD. You have to fill out their paperwork. It's called 15C211. And that thing was, I mean, they came back at me with just, they put me with, one of their compliance officers was named Claire. She was apparently an older woman. She was just mean as dirt, hateful. I really liked her. And she didn't mess around. And I said, the SEC said this is okay. She said, that's not us. We're not the SEC. NASD is a private policing body. You don't get a trading symbol until you meet our requirements. Yes, evil mistress, I am not worthy of your hatred. So you've got to get that. Because otherwise, you're selling stock to people who can't trade it because there's no trading symbol. So that finally got done. And as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, we finally got the trading symbol 2 days after the SEC said we could go live. So we really couldn't go live because no one had put the juice into the stock, which is the trading symbol that runs across the tickers. So all that, there's that. Understand that kind of allows me to slide back toward the middle of this lecture. You've got an offering. Now, it could be your IPO, your initial public offering, or you could have a seasoned offering. If a company sold stock, did its IPO 10 years ago, but it wants to raise more equity capital, well, then it would have to go through the process again with another registration statement to sell the new stock. Now, some companies do a trick called a shelf registration, where they register with one whopping S1, a monster amount of stock, and the SEC qualifies it, and then they will pull off the shelf some of that every now and then and sell that, because it is registered and it's in the live part of the offering. So that's one way you can get around constantly doing seasoned offerings if you want to raise equity capital. Okay, now, common stock. Just because you have a share of common stock doesn't mean, and it's got a trading symbol, doesn't mean that you can sell it. For one thing, now the book kind of gives this a glossy look to it. For example, one One example would be founder stock. When you start a corporation, you're going to grant stock to the founders, to the creators of the corporation. In fact, twice in my time, when companies came to me, they wanted to do an IPO, and then they conveniently, a little later, they said, we don't have any money to pay you, or we have only a little bit to pay you. I say, I'll take some founder stock then, along with you guys who started this. I'm going to take some of it. I'm going to give myself some as well as you. Well, you're going to do it. I'm going to tell you what to do, and you are going to give me so many shares of stock. And I'll see to it, and you give yourself shares. So that's founder stock. Now, founder stock, they can't just run out and sell that stock. If I have privately placed stock, before I did my IPO, I was raising money from investors, wealthy, sophisticated investors. They can't just run out and sell their stock either because it was never registered. The founder's stock was never registered. And in fact, there are several other types. The broad term is that this stock is called restricted. And literally, in the old days, the stock certificate of restricted stock would have a big red stamp on the certificate, restricted. That means that it can't be sold. Now, the restriction is most likely under Rule 144A. Matter of fact, you'll hear me say, this is Rule 144 stock. We'd say it that way, restricted stock. What that means is that within the securities laws, there is this rule that says restricted stock can be sold only under these conditions. Among those conditions are time and timing. Let me explain. Let's say the CEO of a big company wants to sell some of his stock. Well, actually he can, but only at certain intervals, in certain windows. And also, they can't sell stock, say, right before they do an earnings announcement. Because otherwise, the insiders could say, well, tomorrow we're going to report that our earnings sucked, so let's all sell our stock today. Can't do that. Rule 144 puts limits on how much stock, when, and under what conditions. But they could, and what happens? But in order for this to happen, in order for me to sell you, madam, some of my insider, my restricted stock, it will go through a stock transfer agent. The original certificate will, with the restricted. Then the stock transfer agent will issue a new certificate to you without the restricted. But that stock transfer agent will not do that without an opinion of counsel saying that this meets the requirements of Rule 144A. The stock transfer agent is not going to do a thing until that until he's got that letter. The legal counsel has to determine that this sale qualifies under Rule 144A. Can do it, but only with that letter. I believe it was Jeff Bezos last week, or maybe early this week, there was an announcement that he sold several billion dollars worth of his stock. And it gives the impression that an insider can just sell his stock anytime he wants. No, that would have been Rule 144 stock, and he sold it only because the opinion of legal counsel was that the sale qualified under Rule 144A. That's the only reason it could have been done. If he had done it without benefit of opinion of counsel, it would have been illegal, and there wouldn't have been any broker, trader, stock transfer agent on this planet who would have touched it. So there's a lot behind stories that the average reader would not know about. But anyway, that's restricted stock. And something interesting, just a slight side note. A company, maybe it's public, or maybe it's doing its IPO. They can slide private placement stock into a registration of a public offering. We're offering 1 million shares of common stock in this IPO or in this seasoned offering. But you have to dig around and you see that they're also registering some stock from private placements before that. So they're actually dumping more stock into the market than it might first appear if they're also piggybacking on the registration of new common stock, some old restricted common stock. It's done. There's even one way that you can do it straight up without an offering. It's called Form 10. I'll talk about that next week. But anyway, those are some of the little restrictions on the whole process. Now let me go on here. Okay. There's also classes of stock. Most people think, oh, I buy common stock. Well, you might actually be buying a class of common stock. Many companies don't have different classes, but some do. The classical reason for the classes of stock would be that you would want the founding family or the insiders to have super voting rights on the board, to the board of directors. In other words, one vote per share. You might have a class A or that has 10 votes or 100 votes per share. That's not your stock, but it's out there, and that ensures that the founding family or people like that always will maintain control of the company. Very quickly, let me show you. And I've shown you this one before, and now it has a little more meat to it. BRK, Berkshire Hathaway. I'm going to show you the baby Berks. Each one of them gives you one vote. And you get to say, hey, I'm an owner of Berkshire Hathaway. $415.95 a share. But there are also big Berks, BRKA. $628,762.50 per share. Now you might want to look under the seat of your sofa to see if you got enough to buy a couple of shares. But you can see the value is so insane because you are one of the, you get to sit near Warren Buffett at the annual shareholders meeting. You get to be in the same room with him, so you get to breathe the air that he exhaled. You get to breathe in the farts the old guy let off. I mean, that's pretty impressive when you got that kind of action. Yeah, smell my suit. That's Warren Buffett's fart. Yes, that's the whole point of these shares, is their value is in the power that they command. You're one of the controllers of capital. Welcome to the bourgeois, the upper level of the bourgeois. Okay, so that gives you an idea. And I swear, I don't remember. I'm not absolutely sure. But I was going through some financial statements. Now, the shareholders' equity, they got the par value of the common stock, and you got the additional paid-in capital, and they have to list how many shares are outstanding on the left side of that line on the balance sheet. And if you look, sometimes you'll see Class A, Class B. They'll list the different classes there. And I'm almost sure, I shouldn't say this, but I think it was Netflix. They had several different classes of common stock that they were reporting on that line for additional paid-in capital. That surprised me. But once in a while, you'll run into a company, and you're never going to get one of the super voting shares. What's being traded would be the common people's common shares, as it were. So keep that in mind, that you might aspire someday to have $628,000, now $540, that you can pony up so you can say that you're bros with Warren Buffett. It's an aspiration we all have, I'm sure. Anyway, you got a quiz to take. That's all I have for you in the lecture today. I thank you.